Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, why do people seem to know so little about politics? And what does that mean for democracy? We'll speak with political scientist Arthur Lupia. Then, on the Scholar Circle, what is love? Is it emotional, biological? Can it be summoned by rational decision? And how does it play out in society? Why do people seem to know so little about politics? And what does that mean for democracy? Arthur Lupia is with us. Arthur Lupia is a professor of political science at the University of Michigan and research professor at the Institute for Social Research. He's the author of The Democratic Dilemma, Stealing the Initiative, and the latest, Uninformed, Why People Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Arthur Lupia. It's great to have you here with us.
Thanks for having me.
In your introduction, you give us a sense of how much information there really is out there and how we could never really master it. So like how much governments do, laws that are passed, rules that are promulgated, decisions by the courts. Give us a sense of how much there really is and why you say we can't possibly know all this.
Well, sometimes when we talk about politics, particularly when we're frustrated, we like to tell stories about the ignorant voters, the people who disagree with us, and if only they knew certain things, they'd come around and be better citizens. So we can sit there and ask about, well, who are these ignorant citizens? And if we think about it for a moment, and all the things you could know about politics, what we realize is there's really two types of people. One type of person recognizes that there's so much that they don't know about politics, and the other type is delusional about how much they know. And so the example would be, in the United States, the Congress, even when it seems to be dysfunctional, passes 200 to 300 laws per year, and the state where I live passes another 200 laws per year, and the city in which I live passes about 100 laws a year. Even though I'm known as one of the world's experts on political information, I couldn't name more than 10 of the laws, I think, in any given year. Moreover, after a law is written, usually there are rules about how it's enforced, and those rules typically, every word has the rule of law in the sense that, you know, the interpretation written in a rule is binding. So I know almost nothing about that, and that puts me in the same place as everyone. So if we're going to look at the ignorant voters, you know, the first place we have to look is in the mirror. But that doesn't mean that we cast bad votes, because if you think about how we drive in traffic or what we understand about the food we eat, there's all kinds of questions we can't answer. And yet many of us live to a ripe old age by driving and eating. And the way that we do that is by finding simple pieces of information that lead us to make really good decisions. And so a lot of what my book is about is when people can do that and when they can't do that, and how we as educators can help them do a better job.
You've talked about attention, learning, and retention. What do we need to understand about how people think and decide and remember in order to be able to have a relatively civically educated citizenship?
Yeah, that's a great question. So suppose that you and I or some members of our audience wanted to teach some children or other adults in our community something about a policy, something about the way it affected our lives, or something about how our future could be if we made different choices. The question now is, how do we convey that information? One way of thinking about it is just the facts. That is, if we lay the facts out in front of people, if we repeat the facts enough, if we, you know, make long books or give long lectures, detailed lectures about the facts, at some point the information will go through. The problem is that biology doesn't work that way. That's not really how brains work. In particular, there are so many things competing for our attention at any given moment. And even when somebody throws a book in front of us or stands in front of us and give a lecture, we always have the option not to pay attention. To be polite, we often pretend we're paying attention, but we can think about our laundry or sports or whatever it is. And so to achieve the learning outcomes that we typically desire, a critical thing is to try and provide information that not only helps people make better decisions, but that also gets their attention. When we're trying to get people's attention, the thing that, you know, someone like myself or you know, people in the media have to think about is we're competing. We're competing with other noises in the room, and we're competing with all the things online, like cat videos, which many people find very entertaining. And so to the extent that we want our messages to get through, we have to find a way to outcompete the other things to which they could pay attention. And to make a long story short, the types of information that people really like are information that they can see as helping them solve a problem that they have. So if we want to talk about global climate change, for example, people don't see that as a problem that they have, but they do see dirty water and dirty air and pollution as problems that they have. And so beginning to tell a story about things that they can do to improve the water and air in that neighborhood is a gateway to helping people be more interested in things like global climate change. So in order to get people's attention, you really have to speak to their core concerns and their core values.
Is this what you were referring to when you talked about cues?
Yes, cues are a big deal. So if you and I are out for a drive and we are approaching an intersection and we're trying to figure out whether to hit the gas or hit the brake, there's a lot of things typically we can look at. If we're at a busy intersection, we can think about all the other drivers and their cars and how fast they could go and what they might possibly be thinking in terms of whether they're going to go fast or slow. There are all these things we could look at, or we could listen to the radio or look at the clouds. But what a lot of us tend to do is look at stoplights. And if the stoplight's a certain color, we stop. And if it's another color, we go. And so there's this simple environmental cue that gives us a lot of information about how to make a decision that will help us. We do that all the time when we choose brand names when looking at food, or when we decide to approach or run away from an animal. And so in politics, you know, making what seems to be a complicated decision can sometimes be made a lot easier if we find the right cue. And in many countries, one of the best cues is a party label. Understanding that someone is a liberal or from a labor party or a conservative can tell people a lot about that candidate that can help them make a decision that they'll be happy about later.
And some would argue that this is the whole point of framing and political advertising and that type of a thing, storytelling even. But this can sometimes give bad information, can't it?
Yes. No. When you take a shortcut, it can lead you to a place you want to go, but sometimes it leads you to a bad place. In politics, this cue-taking, I think it works well in a competitive environment where people are able to tell multiple sides of the story, and you can learn over time which cues work for you and which cues don't. So you can learn that a conservative person or a labor person is more likely to pursue the types of policies that you like or that are better for your family or your community or whatever you care about. But in some cases, when you see like a very slick TV ad and you don't know who's behind it and they make a very visceral claim and you're compelled by it, that's where this type of thinking can become very dangerous, because, you know, someone can tell you that, you know, voting for the taller candidate is a great thing, and they show you a movie about how this tall candidate does lots of wonderful things, but in real life, the tall candidate is very ineffective or awful. And because you didn't think through where this information was coming from, you made the wrong choice. So cues work really well when you have time to get experience with them and learn about which ones work and which ones don't.
One of the issues that some political scientists have talked about and many civic educators talk about is the idea that voters often vote against their own interests. And this was the whole argument of Thomas Frank and What's the Matter with Kansas. And I think your colleague Larry Bartels did that one experiment that you then countered that dealt with George W. Bush's tax cuts and conservatives supporting it or not supporting it based on how much information they got. I wonder if you could help us to understand both the role of information, but other roles too that lead voters to choose against their own interests.
Let me sort of present that in a slightly different way to just help us think about that, because sometimes when we are passionate about an issue or a point of view or a policy, and we see someone else voting differently, a natural reaction to say is, how can they do that? Like, how can they not know that the issue that I prefer or the candidate I prefer is really the right way forward? And so a natural story that we tell ourselves is, well, the other person is ignorant. And if I tell them what I know, they'll change their minds and they'll see that I'm right. But what's interesting about politics is that information isn't the only thing that separates us. Values and experiences and backgrounds separate us as well. And so a policy that might be really great for me could be really bad for you. And if you had all the information that was available about it, you would still vote the other way. When I think about the questions that you've asked me, the mistake that we often make is to think, well, the only reason that someone would vote differently than I do is because they're stupid. But when you look into it, so when you look into the Thomas Frank work or the Larry Bartels work, and these types of claims are made, what I have done is shown, okay, well, why don't we learn a little bit more about these people who are voting differently than we are and try to find out that if we actually gave them more information, would they change their minds? Or if we even gave them more information years later and say, how do you feel about that choice you made 5 or 10 years ago? What we find out is they're still happy with it. And what we learned at those moments was it wasn't ignorance that distinguished us initially. It was the idea that, you know, I'm a tall person and someone else is a short person. And so we have different preferences about how tall doorways are, right? There's a difference in our life that leads us to want to make different decisions. And so I think when we look at this idea about who's casting a correct vote, one of the things you really have to consider is, well, what is the other person's life like? And their circumstance might be really different than yours, in which case you might not be happy about the case that they're voting differently, but they're entirely justified in doing so.
Well, can we look at that one issue that you studied as well as your colleague Larry Bartels studied as an example that people could come to terms with, which was the tax cuts that George Bush W. Jr. Yeah. proposed?
Right. In Larry Bartels' paper, the claim was that this was in 2004 in the USA, and there was a question about how do you feel about the tax cuts that President Bush was proposing. And Bartels' claim was that the less you knew about politics, the more likely you were to support the tax cut. And so he said, well, ignorance is leading to the tax cut. But what I showed is that his result was only holding for people who identified as liberals or on the left. And when you gave conservatives more information or the equivalent of it, they actually liked the tax cuts more because that policy was consistent with their point of view. So this is a case where, you know, even leading economists disagree on whether you should have tax cuts to stimulate the economy, whether you should have government spending to stimulate the economy, or in fact, whether you should try to stimulate the economy at all. Leading economists disagree on these things. And yet some authors will write, because the public disagrees with my point of view on a tax cut, they must have been ignorant. So what I've shown in my work is that there is a large group of people in the United States, people who call themselves conservatives, who even when they're very smart by, you know, conventional measures, they still like the policies that someone like Professor Bartels thought was a bad idea.
So would this fall into, for example, in the Bush tax cuts scenario, a lot of people who may have been of little means, who were not going to benefit from the tax cuts and would see the shift go to wealthier people, right? So they personally right. wouldn't benefit from the tax cut. So you're saying that ideologically, they still supported it.
There's the data that we were looking at doesn't really allow us to go much deeper. But here's a bigger idea. That we don't get to vote on one issue at a time. And so, you know, people who have lesser means may wish that, you know, they had more money or more resources, but people may have very different theories about how that should come about, you know, whether the government should give them money or redistribute it, or whether they should do something differently. And there is a different set of different points of view. Moreover, some people who are conservative who have little means, you know, they may realize at some level that the tax cuts won't help them, but they understand that they're part of a theory of government that, in the aggregate, leads to outcomes that they like more. So, for example, you know, many people who are conservative want low government intervention in, you know, the economy. In the U.S., that point of view is tied up with certain attitudes on abortion. And so to the extent that they're saying, well, maybe on this one issue, I wish the world were different, the things that President Bush is doing in general, his theory in general, is leading to a better life for me as I see it. And so even if the tax cuts don't benefit me directly, I'm happy to go along with them. So these are all explanations that exist in the U.S. electorate, which makes the simple story, you disagree with me, so you must be wrong. It undermines that story.
You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and we're talking with Arthur Lupia about his new book, Uninformed: Why So Many People Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It. Do you think that this is really supporting some of the studies that have been done among psychologists, like the Drew Weston studies that show we get sort of married to a particular perspective, and no matter what information comes in, we stick to that perspective kind of emotionally, and counter-information actually gives us cognitive dissonance?
Well, I will say, I mean, this is a conversion that I've had over my professional life. My background is in mathematics, and when I first started looking at this issue, my natural inclination was to think that we analyze information first and maybe we have feelings about it later. But what the scholarship, particularly over the last 30 years, has shown, and certainly Drew Weston's work is an example, is that our typical reaction to information is to feel it first and then maybe to think about it later. And so if I feel that a piece of information is threatening to me or my point of view, one of the things I'll try to do is distance myself from it. And so that's what we see. The psychologists now call it motivated reasoning, but it's the idea that I will discount a piece of information, not because I think it's false, but because I think it's threatening. So I'm just going to try and keep it as far away from me as I can. To the contrary, if I see a piece of information that supports my point of view, that raises my self-esteem and reminds me of how awesome I am, I'm going to try and inflate the importance of that information, and I'm going to tell everybody about it. I'm not going to inspect it very much. And so as we look at how people process information, this selective exposure and cognitive dissonance that you talked about, they're huge elements. At the same time, there's a limit to it. When we can tie a piece of information that threatens us to an outcome that we really care about, we think about it, right? That's how we learn. And it's these critical moments where, you know, we can adopt a new perspective or find a new sympathy for someone. So it's not simply the case that we make a set of decisions when we're 20 and then we never change our minds.
So this has to do with also another question you've looked at about scaring citizens.
That's right. One of the great opportunities for civic educators today is to try and figure out how to take a piece of information and tell a story about it in a way that connects to the lives that people lead and the things that they think are important. And when you do that, people are willing to listen, right? And so if you tell people that they have a bad ideology or that they're wrong, they tend to shut you down. They tend to ignore you. But one of the great, I think, largely untapped opportunities for people who really want to make a difference in society is not just to talk at someone, but to listen and to think about the lives that they lead, and then to try and convey whatever it is you know in terms of what they really think is important.
So if you look at the current political climate in the United States, and the whole world is watching, how does what's happening and the information and the emotions fit within this model?
Sure. Well, let's talk about the Republican side, because I know that's probably more exciting and people have seen it. There's a historical note that I'm not sure is covered a lot because it's not as exciting as Donald Trump. And that is, for roughly 40 years, there's been a pretty big division within the Republican Party. There's been one group within the Republican Party who we call establishment Republicans who have conservative principles and actually like the idea of government pursuing conservative principles. But there's another faction within the Republican Party who just really want the government out of life as much as possible. They're known as the Tea Party or Movement Conservatives. They've had an uneasy truce for about 40 years, and you know, the political genius of someone like Ronald Reagan or George W. Bush was that they found a way to talk to both of those groups simultaneously. But over the last 10 or 15 years, those groups have grown more and more apart, particularly after the economic crisis of 2008, where under President Bush, the government intervened in a pretty big way to forestall a larger economic collapse. So now we come to 2016, and you have an electorate, particularly in the Tea Party, that are really, really disappointed in the establishment Republicans. And, you know, Donald Trump, one of the first things he did was really talk to that type of voter and say, I understand that you're frustrated, and I'm going to give you some simple ways out of it. We're going to keep the Mexicans away. We're going to impose tariffs. I mean, you may or may not like those policies, but he tapped into the frustration that had been in the Republican Party for 40 years in a way that no other Republican had. And so, whatever you think of Donald Trump, he clearly understood and tapped into something that you know, a lot of people saw in the Republican Party, but no one really figured out how to cultivate. The other thing about Donald Trump that, you know, what he understands from his time in television is how to get attention. And what we may long for the days where all political discourse was at a very high level and very long speeches and so forth, and there are people who are interested in that, so lots of people worldwide who are interested in that, but there are other folks who are just really frustrated, and Donald Trump speaks to them.
So how does, say, what Donald Trump has done fit into this model that you've been writing about in terms of information cues, attention getting, retention, and, you know, whether or not voter ignorance is playing into this?
Voter ignorance plays into all of it, but that's just because voter ignorance is always present. Just, again, going back to the beginning, there's so many things that all of us are ignorant about. I think what Donald Trump was fantastic at was phrasing very strong ideas in two or three words. So on any given day, you knew what he was talking about and you knew what his position was. And the media here loved it. At the same time, simple ideas and some of the contradictions that Donald Trump has expressed, I think this is where simple cues pointing out these contradictions, pointing out the lack of feasibility of some of his proposals, somebody using the same strategies that have led him to succeed could really undermine him. So I think that's out there. I think the Republicans had a difficult time doing it, in part because most of the Republican consultants in this country were just counting on him to implode. And so they did not attack him early in ways that I think strategies in my book would have helped.
So in essence, what you're saying is he uses these cues, these emotional cues, that perhaps opponents should use.
If we think about in the Republican primary, at the beginning, Governor Bush, Senator Rubio, and Senator Cruz had a huge monetary advantage. They had hundreds of millions of dollars lined up behind their campaigns to run ads. And yet, Donald Trump really scooped them in terms of how to talk to an angry part, a frustrated part of the Republican electorate. And Bush and Rubio, they just never figured it out. I mean, Rubio, I think, figured it out about a week before he dropped out of the campaign. Senator Cruz was really targeting a group of religious voters who are well-identified. I mean, he did as well as any candidate who's tried to get those voters, and his message really it's not a general election message, so I don't think Cruz could have changed strategies in the way that my book would recommend and get a larger set of the electorate, because he had a pretty narrow appeal, and that was part of, you know, why he had an appeal at all. Governor Bush and Governor Rubio, I think they were running, you know, 2000 or 2008 era campaigns in 2016, where you really need to be more attentive to how to get people's attention.
Let's go back to framing this whole question that we're getting to, which is really how much do citizens need to know and how much information do they need to know for a democracy to really work well?
That's the big question. I'll give a simple answer, and the simple answer is the amount of information you need depends on what you're doing. So if you're in the United States of America in November of 2016 and you have a Democrat Hillary Clinton and a Republican Donald Trump, a chimp with a coin gets that right half the time. If you think that, you know, but what a voter needs to figure out is which of these two options is better. You're not writing a constitution. You're not writing a contract where there's a million options. There's two options. And so you need enough information to figure out, is the Democrat better or is the Republican better? And that's where you can count on history and what they say and what they've done to try and make a decision. That's a pretty low bar, choosing one out of two. Again, if you flip a coin, you're likely to get it right half the time. And if you can do a little better than flipping a coin by looking at history and what they do, you can do a lot better. In fact, most people who vote in presidential elections, if you ask them years later, how do you feel about that vote you've cast? You know, in part because there's only two choices, most people wouldn't change their vote. They're like, you know, I'm happy with how this is gone. Now, there are other people, if we talk about democracy working, there are some people who only have to make simple choices on certain days, and that's the typical voter. There are other people in the legislature, and there are people in the bureaucracy, and there are people who work in the judiciary, and they have really important jobs. And them being very expert on how nuclear weapons work, or what happens when you send soldiers into a particular area, or what happens when you try to change your pipes from pipes that have no lead in them to pipes that have lead. You want experts on the ground. And so information is really important to a democracy, but the key is not to try and teach everybody everything, because that's impossible, right? The key is to give people the information that they can use for the tasks that are actually in front of them. And that's why getting voter education right is so important, and that's what most of the book's about. And it's also why, you know, when we think about who we elect to office, just making sure that they know the things that they need to know.
For civic educators, and you identify all kinds of people as civic educators, besides political scientists and media people, there are really people who are active in politics, party activists, all kinds of people. What would you say that they need to be doing in order to bring people to the knowledge where they are making decisions at least consistent with what they ultimately would want?
The one thing that people in my position don't do enough is listen. So we go in front of an audience and we just start talking and we just start telling people about why what we know is so important. And I love people who know things and are willing to share it with other people. But because attention is limited, one of the most important things to know when an educator walks into the room is, why is the other person there? Why are the students there? What do they want? What are their priorities? And what are their values? And if you can find a way to speak to those things and convey your information from that framework, you'll have an audience. But if you just try to talk at people, or you threaten their values, or you don't think about why they're in the room, you just think they have some obligation to listen to you, and you're wrong about that, people will nod to be polite, but they're not paying attention, and they're not thinking. And when they leave the room, they'll have forgotten everything you've said. So the most important thing, I think, for an educator to do is to really think about, what's in this moment, this potential educational moment, for the other person in the room? And how can I serve that person? If you can figure out a way to do that and convey your information, you'll have an audience. And when you measure whether or not you had an effect on them, chances are you will.
Thank you so much, Arthur Lupia, for this research and for joining us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you for having me.
Arthur Lupia is a professor of political science at the University of Michigan and research professor at the Institute for Social Research. He's the author of The Democratic Dilemma, Stealing the Initiative, and the latest, Uninformed, Why People Know So Little About Politics and What We Can Do About It. When we come back, we'll explore the big questions of love.
I carry your heart with me. I carry it in my heart. I am never without it. Anywhere I go, you go, my dear. And whatever is done by only me is your doing, my darling. I fear no fate, for you are my fate, my sweet. I want no world, for beautiful you are my world, my true. And it's you are whatever a moon has always meant, and whatever a sun will always sing is you. Here is the deepest secret nobody knows. Here is the root of the root, and the bud of the bud, and the sky of the sky of a tree called life, which grows higher than soul can hope or mind can hide. And this is the wonder that's keeping the stars apart. I carry your heart. I carry it in my heart.
E.E. Cummings reading I Carry Your Heart With Me.
Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. We're exploring the big questions of love. What is love exactly? How have notions of love changed over time? Can love be consciously developed? And how does love for partner, friends, children, and country differ? With us are three scholars. Simon May is with us. He is visiting professor of philosophy at King's College in London and author of numerous books, including Love, A History, and Nietzsche's Ethics and His War on Morality. Bennett Helm also joins us. He is professor of philosophy at Franklin and Marshall College. His books include Love, Friendship, and the Self, and Emotional Reason, Deliberation, Motivation, and the Nature of Value. Robert Epstein also joins us. He is senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. He's currently working on a book called Making Love, How People Learn to Love and How You Can Too. He's also the author of Cognition, Creativity, and Behavior, Selected Essays. Thank you so much for being with us. Simon May, I want to start with you. You've said that over time, love has become like a religion, and as a result, perhaps it's ossified. Free love hasn't freed love, maybe caged it instead. How is love like a religion, and what happened to get us here?
I think love is like a religion because it's come to take on many of the attributes that were previously or currently attributed by religious people to God. In other words, we claim that we love, for example, unconditionally, that we love selflessly, and that our love, or at least our genuine love, is enduring, or in some sense even eternal. And those are qualities, to be unconditional, to be selfless, and to be eternal. Those are really divine qualities that don't apply to anything, in my view, that human beings do, which is always conditional and is always time-limited. And is in one way or another always self-interested. I think even altruism can be self-interested.
So you're saying, in essence, these ideals that we hold about love are unrealistic. How did we then come to embrace them?
Well, I have a particular story about that, which is that essentially the view gained ground. So it's relatively recent, if you look at the whole history of Western thought, in the Protestant Reformation, that human beings were deemed unable to love at all without divine grace. So the odd result was that human beings got, if you like, deified by that. In fact, Luther, the founder of the Reformation, even said that human beings could become gods through love. Because we were so incapable of loving ourselves, we could only love if God, so to speak, inspired us to love through his own love. Now, of course, his own love, by definition, is unconditional because God isn't conditioned by anything beyond him. So this is how the thought came into being, that human love could be unconditional. But religion always had a countervailing doctrine of modesty. It always said that if we could love unconditionally, it was only because God was infusing it into us. And I think that when we came to the 18th century, to the Enlightenment, and to the beginning of the decline of belief in religion, even by religious people, I can explain what I mean by that later if you wish, we were left with the conceit that we could love unconditionally, but we dropped the doctrine of modesty that we needed God's grace to do so. And I think that that is basically where we are today.
Well, you said that as a result of this, love has become ossified. What did you mean by that?
What I mean by that, human beings have a fundamental religious need. In other words, we need to have some value that we hold as absolutely supreme and in a sense as redeeming the horrors and the losses and the sufferings of life. And a lot of things have been tried since faith in God started getting wobbly. Science, technology, capitalism, communism, and a bevy of other isms have been tried, and one by one they've been found wanting. But only love has somehow kept its hold over the... And I'm talking about largely now about the Western imagination. I don't want to speak for cultures beyond the West. I think that because love has exerted this unique hold, we've been terrified to allow it to evolve. So I point out, for example, in the book to which you referred, that while we've had a tremendous revolution in, say, freeing sexuality, we have not at the same time freed love. So the pill, the admission of gay love, and obviously, much freer sex heterosexually, has all happened during the 20th century and into the 21st. But the concepts, but the way in which we think of love itself has remained remarkably fixed or even ossified.
Bennett Helm, would you agree?
There are a number of things that I would tend to disagree with in what Simon has just said. It's not clear to me that we need a value that we hold absolutely supreme. I think it's important to see that part of what's distinctive of human life is that we do have things that we find to be valuable. And in part, we define our identities as persons through the various things that we find to be valuable. And in this, I think love plays a central and important role. Part of what I think happens in love is that you find the other person to be valuable, and you come to value the things that the other person values for that person's sake. That's a kind of intimate identification that I think is really at the root of love. I would want to pass on some of the historical considerations that Simon has just alluded to. I'm not a historian, not even a historian of philosophy. But to a certain extent, I would agree with Simon that it is unrealistic to say that we love unconditionally, that we love selflessly and eternally. But the difficult task in trying to understand the nature of love is really to understand how it is that love can be conditioned on who the beloved is, what kind of role that yourself has to play in the loving of someone else, and the ways in which we can be justified in coming to love someone, the way in which we can be justified in ceasing to love someone or continuing to love someone. So those are all important questions, philosophical questions, that any account of love needs to sort of take on and try to give an answer to.
You were alluding to one of your concepts, which is this evaluative aspect of love. And I just briefly wanted to understand what you meant by that.
Love is partly an emotional response. I don't think of love itself as an emotion. I think love is a mode of concern that we have that is constituted by a variety of emotions. And when you start looking at the emotions, particular emotions are going to evaluate their objects in various kinds of ways. So in the simplest case, you know, think of a relatively simple emotion like fear. You're evaluating the object as dangerous, as threatening something that you care about, something that's important to you. So there's an evaluative aspect to emotions quite generally. The emotions that I think are most relevant to thinking about love are what I call person-focused emotions. These are emotions like pride and shame that essentially take persons as their objects, and they involve evaluations of those persons as ennobled, for example. Well, depending on the circumstances, you're evaluating the person in terms of the quality of that person's life in having these various sorts of emotions. And I think that's an important way in which we come to identify with someone in this distinctively intimate sort of way that love is.
Robert Epstein, you have looked at this from a different perspective in terms of love, mostly romantic love, and you've done a bit of historic evaluation on this as well. Let's start there and then go into the actual concept of developing love.
You know, I've looked at love in different cultures. I've looked at love historically. As a research psychologist, so I tend to collect data and kind of draw conclusions from data. And I have to agree with some of the things actually that Simon May said, because love was actually not very important, certainly in marriages for a long, long time. Still not very important in many cultures, believe it or not. But it has become, over time, in Western cultures, especially in Europe and the U.S., it has become more important over time. So if you go back 100 years, the vast majority of people who married in the U.S. and Europe would say that they would marry without love. It wasn't necessary. It wasn't a requirement. But at this point, certainly in the U.S., 90 to 95% of people who marry say that they would not marry unless there was love. So there have been changing attitudes, and we have locked in on certain ideas about love. They're really myths. It's exactly what Simon was talking about. I talk about them in the context of mythology, but there are a lot of myths that surround the modern concept of love. And from my perspective, these are myths that actually harm people, and myths that harm relationships, because they set up expectations that real relationships just cannot fulfill, and as a result, relationships fail, people end up in therapy or divorce court. So indeed, we are locked into certain ideas about love which are false.
You know, both you and I believe Simon May have written about this aspect. Simon May, you called it consumerism and how it has changed our concept of love. And I don't think that's what you called it, Robert Epstein, but I think it was a related concept.
Actually, if I can just butt in here.
Yes,
no, I didn't say that consumerism has changed our concept. On the contrary, what I said was that the, so to speak, consumerist attitude to love, in other words, because of the acceptability of divorce and the social acceptability of breakup of relationships and the availability of contraception and the like, we are more able, in fact, to pursue the traditional ideal than ever before because, to use the current jargon, we can move on from one relationship to the other or from one marriage to the other. And so what I'm saying, and this is part of my point about ossification, is that the, in a sense, the ideal of love, the concept of what we're looking for, has more or less stayed the same. But the consumerism of love, in other words, being able to look for it, as it were, change one model for another and so on, has enabled us to pursue the ideal in an ever more aggressive way. I mean, sometimes literally aggressive way. So though people very often say it's either consumerism or it's idealism, I see the consumerism is reinforcing the idealism.
Robert Epstein, I heard you coming in.
Well, yes, I would agree there. And again, we're moving in a direction which is probably going to do more harm when it comes to love because the internet has made it easier than ever just to keep moving on. I call it the click problem when it comes to love because we have an ideal that is virtually impossible to match, certainly for any length of time in any real relationship. And so we just click, and we move on to someone else and someone else and someone else. It's as if we're standing at a bar that's 1,000 miles long. There's an endless supply of people to replace our current partner with. And as a result, again, this impossible standards that we hold for love are never met.
Bennett Helm.
I would agree. There is, to a certain extent, a mythology about love, but I think it's partly a shallow mythology about love that doesn't recognize the way in which love involves very deep interpersonal relationships, deep interpersonal relationships that we need to work on and we need to constantly re-engage with our partners in the process of loving them. I think this is a problem not just for romantic love, but I think it's a problem for other types of love as well, familial sorts of love, friendship love. We always need to engage intimately with our beloveds so as to fulfill the promise of love, but it's not going to be this sort of mythological thing that's falling in love with your ideal. Once you've achieved the love, you know, everything will be happy ever after. That's not the kind of thing that love is.
Bennett Helm, something belongs in here that you've written about. You've called this individualistic approach. What is the difference between this individualistic approach versus this pluralist approach?
Part of the question is how we should understand the nature of intimacy, the kind of intimacy that is characteristic of love. And I think in some philosophical approaches to understanding love, there's a tendency to understand intimacy in terms of sort of your own concern for yourself, so egocentrically. And the way we make sense of my concern for another is in part by understanding the other's interests to be a part of my own interest. That gives rise to various problems about, you know, how you can maintain the distinctness of the identity of the two individuals. If you're breaking down the boundaries between them in such a way that you can't identify some interests as yours versus your beloved's, it gives rise to problems about how we can make sense of how my love involves a concern for the other, for my beloved's sake, with an idea that I think is central to the notion of love. So part of the problem then is to figure out a way to reconceive that notion of intimacy. And, well, part of what I've tried to do in some of my works and part of what I'm trying to do by thinking about the way in which love involves these distinctively interpersonal emotions is to try to reconceive that notion of intimacy in a way that gives rise to a much more robust, much more interpersonal understanding of the nature of love.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about the phenomenon of love. Simon May, you've also talked about this idea of individualism, and you've talked about self-love as the other side of the coin of other love. How does that fit in?
Before I answer that question, may I comment on some things Bennett Helm has said? Because I think there's a kind of central point that, if I could say this, is missing in what he's saying, which is he's talking about intimacy and the dynamics of intimacy and actually raising a number of questions that Aristotle raised about how you can see the other person as a second self, but nonetheless the process is directed by your own interest. But I think Bennett Helm is not distinguishing between, as it were, the dynamics of intimacy and what this whole intimacy is actually for. In other words, when we're intimate with somebody, when we say we love them, when we want to combine our lives and combine our projects and so on, or be second selves to each other, what is driving us? What are the values external to that intimacy? I mean, why do we think we're doing all this? And I think that Benatar sounds like he's focusing on the, you know, what's going on in the intimacy and how to make some of those things work. But the larger question is, what do we think we're doing this for? Now, there was a time when people thought they were doing all this for God. So they were loving the other and they were figuring out, you know, the virtues of intimacy and so on, because there was this larger thing which was called loving God, which was the primary duty. Then there were other thinkers who thought that they were doing this because it was part of a flourishing life. So that would be, say, Aristotle, who thought that human flourishing depended on this. And I think this is where my point, which Benatar disagreed with about religion, comes in, which is that I think Nietzsche rightly said that human beings have an inextinguishable religious need. And to be precise, and this is why I mentioned the supreme value, a religion must, among other things, posit some state of affairs which is venerated as supremely valuable. In fact, you can call it sacred, because through it, salvation from whatever we most fear in life can be found. Now, I think love has started to play this role. In other words, that love is this precisely this supreme state of affairs, venerated as supremely valuable, in fact as sacred, and we speak of love as sacred, because in some sense, through love, we can find salvation from, you know, the many things that we fear, loss of career, loss of money, loss indeed of relatives and loved ones. And I think that one has to focus on that, because that's one of the things that's driving love today. Once you've focused on that, you can then focus in on, well, how do we then get this intimacy? How do we achieve this intimacy? What is it to identify with the projects of one's loved one? If we do so, as Bennett just said, do we in some sense dissolve our individuality if we regard the other as a second self? So I think all the questions he's asking are great, but they do need to be situated in a larger context, which is, what purposes do we see the intimacy as serving?
I do agree with much of what Simon has just said, and this is getting partly to the question that you had asked earlier about the sense in which love involves evaluations. In coming to love someone, we're finding that person to be valuable and important, not only for their sakes, but also valuable and important in our own lives. And part of the way in which we can justify a loving relationship is in terms of the way in which that loving relationship affects and changes and deepens your own sense of your own identity. And this is kind of getting to some of those issues that Simon was just raising about what the dynamics of intimacy is for. Why do we go in for this kind of thing?
And allow me to say, Bennett, that you've just given a classically modern answer to the question I raised. So the idea, for example, I think you just mentioned that love in some sense deepens our sense of identity. One can more or less trace to the Swiss philosopher Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and before him, or certainly before the 18th century, nobody would have given an answer like that. So you are answering the question I pose, but you're answering it as a modern, which is fine. But I think it just does illustrate that we do need to raise the question and check with ourselves what larger purposes we do see love as serving.
Now, if we do fast forward to the modern age, which is what Robert Epstein is studying, Robert Epstein, you've studied how love develops, how people actually come to love. And there are these various aspects that we've been talking about in them, but you found specific experiences as very key. What were those?
Yes, I've been studying how love arises in arranged marriages in about a dozen different cultures around the world, looking specifically at marriages in which there was little or no love at first, and indeed that's very common in arranged marriages, in which over time love emerged. And the question is, how does that happen? And I've looked at 36 different factors over a period of time, and it turns out that the number one factor, the best predictor of the growth of love, and this relates to several things that my colleagues here have spoken about, but the number one factor is actually a commitment, how strongly you're committed to making the relationship work. And, of course, commitment tends to be very weak right now in most Western cultures when it comes to long-term relationships. That's one of the reasons why love often fails for us. I just want to bring up another recent study of mine, which I think is relevant to this discussion. I've also looked at seven different types of skill sets which seem to predict the success of long-term love relationships. And the most important skill set that is the most predictive is communication. That's no big surprise. But the second most predictive skill set, and this is a big surprise, at least it was to me, regarding the success of a loving relationship, is knowledge of partners. And this is, goes to that intimacy question that's been raised several times. That is to say, how much effort do you put into knowing your partner? And that means not just knowing, you know, his or her favorite pizza toppings, but knowing his or her most intimate thoughts, his or her hopes and dreams for the future and so on. Extremely important. So one can study these issues empirically, and it's quite illuminating.
The other aspect of your research I thought was interesting was how vulnerability plus empathy increases people's experience of love.
Yes, this is something I'm studying now, and it's going to take me a few more years, I think, to straighten it all out. But there's a big question about how intimate feelings develop between two people. And it turns out under certain conditions, those feelings will develop almost instantaneously. So, for example, if you and a total stranger are near the site of 9/11 when the buildings came down, which in fact I happen to be, you form an emotional bond, very deep emotional bond that can last a lifetime with whoever happens to be standing next to you, believe it or not. Two men in a foxhole during war form very deep emotional bonds. So the key to this is indeed vulnerability. In other words, how weak you are and your willingness to show how weak you are, how vulnerable you are to another person. And if two people do that at the same time to each other, if they each just lower their defenses, in effect, that causes bonding, very deep emotional bonding, often expressed in the language of love. So I've been looking at how one can make this happen, literally at the drop of a dime. I now have a number of exercises that very quickly make people feel vulnerable in each other's presence and indeed report very strong increases in emotional bond. And in fact, they will talk about liking, attraction, and love itself. Just by going through these kinds of experiences.
I would think that would require that empathy piece, but also the element of trust.
Well, of course, because when you are vulnerable, that means you could be hurt by the other person. So issues of trust are very important there. And in fact, some of us are let down. The classic case is the case of the womanizer, the one who manipulates women, who seduces women. In that case, what's happening is that you cause the woman to feel vulnerable in your presence, sometimes your sheer physicality that makes her feel vulnerable. And when she is now vulnerable, of course, you can take advantage and let her down, so betray her trust. So, yes, as soon as you become vulnerable, issues of trust become very important.
What I wanted to end on deals with another area of love. It's this love of country, which can be translated to nationalism, which sounds a lot like, Simon May, how you have expressed love becoming like a religion. Where does love of country come into all this?
Well, yes, you're absolutely right. I should have actually included nationalism and patriotism as one of my isms. And of course, love of country, nationalistic or patriotic, depending on how you want to see it, has indeed been one of the great religions, not necessarily to great benefit, since the beginning of the death of God, as Nietzsche proclaimed it, in the 18th and 19th centuries. So I think that, in a sense, anything to which we feel profoundly attached can become an object of love, and country is one of those. But I think in the West, we've come to be more mature about that. I think there are very few, except at the fringes, who regard love of country in a sense as über alles, as in a sense taking precedence over everything else and over every other love and loyalty. And indeed, I think there are very few who think that that should be entirely unconditional, so that you should unconditionally support everything that your country does. So in fact, I would include love of country. It's definitely to be included in the list of loves, but I think it's one of the substitutes for God, which we have had to very ugly effect in some cases, obviously like German Nazism and so on, which has now taken a bit of a backseat.
And finally, Bennett Helm, let's bring you back in because you've talked about various kinds of love in your book. What are we leaving out?
One thing that I would caution very much against is making the notion of love, the concept of love, too broad. So rather than saying what we're leaving out, I want to try to contract the notion a little bit. I think there are important distinctions to be made between the kind of intimate relationship, the kind of concern that we have for other adult human beings, and the kinds of concern that we might have for a country, for certain kinds of activities, even the kinds of concern that we have for, you know, very young children. Part of what I take the intimacy to involve is, in a certain sense, the sharing of an identity, which presupposes that the beloved herself has a distinctive identity as a particular person. And I think when you look at, for example, infants, they haven't yet developed an identity. Now, I wouldn't want to say that we don't love our infants. Surely you do, in some sense, love newborn infants. But I think the quality and the character of the kind of concern that you have for a newborn is going to be very different, different in kind, from the kind of concern that you have for a mature adult. And I think we can say similar things about love of country, love of certain kinds of activities, love of wine or food or what have you. Many of those things tend to be very different, and I think we need to keep the differences in mind.
My producer over here says, ask them for Valentine's advice.
This is Robert Epstein. I'd be happy to offer some Valentine's Day advice. The main advice I can give you is be careful about who it is you're loving. In other words, try to find out who that person is. Don't just go with feelings. Use your head as well a little bit, because one of the mistakes we make in our culture is we just get so passionate about someone and the physical attraction takes over, and we forget about other kinds of issues. So just be a little bit careful.
I would say don't be too perfectionist about the other. If it doesn't all feel right on the day, it doesn't mean that it's all not going well. Romance doesn't live or die by perfection.
Let me just thank you all for your time and your research.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Simon May is visiting professor of philosophy at King's College in London and author of numerous books, including Love, A History, and Nietzsche's Ethics and His War on Morality. Bennett Helm is professor of philosophy at Franklin and Marshall College. His books include Love, Friendship, and the Self, and Emotional Reason, Deliberation, Motivation, and the Nature of Value. Robert Epstein is senior research psychologist at the American Institute for Behavioral Research and Technology. He's currently working on a book called Making Love, How People Learn to Love and How You Can Too, and Cognition, Creativity, and Behavior, Selected Essays. Thanks to all who made this program possible, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Sad Dongre, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed a part of the show, you can find our archives at scholarscircle.org. Please like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Armudian. See you next week.